Look, the Republican Party isn't just changing, it's being structurally rebuilt in the image of one person. The Texas primary results are the latest evidence of this MAGAfication. The big news out of the Lone Star State is that Donald Trump's endorsed candidates dominated the recent runoff elections, effectively purging the remaining old guard Republicans from the statehouse. According to reports, this isn't just a localized Texas squabble. It's a signal that the GOP is increasingly a party where loyalty is a one-way street. You give it to Trump, but he doesn't necessarily give it back. We're seeing a widening MAGA gap. While the proportion of self-identified MAGA Republicans is surging within the party, that ideological shift isn't happening in the general electorate. It's a shitty strategic position to be in. The party is catering to an intensely loyal but shrinking faction, while the broader public and even a dispirited non-MAGA Republican base is looking for the exit. Primary turnout is dropping. It turns out that when a party's entire identity is tied to one man's popularity, every candidate becomes a victim of that man's baggage. Democrats, meanwhile, seem to be learning that when your opponent is busy lighting themselves on fire, you shouldn't grab the hose. In the Texas Democratic primaries, voters actually pivoted away from polarizing figures in favor of candidates with crossover appeal. The strategy here is pretty clear. Court the independents and the YOLO Republicans. Those are the guys like Tom Tillis and Mitch McConnell, who are either retiring or have already lost, and suddenly they've found their spines. They're calling out things like Trump's proposed slush fund for supporters. It's a little late for a moral awakening, honestly, but their dissent is putting a lot of pressure on moderates like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. On the world stage, the debate over transactional foreign policy is intensifying as the U.S. navigates a recently volatile Middle East. Critics are pointing to the rising cost of maintaining a military presence in the region, both in terms of munitions and the risk to American personnel, as evidence that the current maximum pressure strategy lacks a clear exit ramp. It's a sharp contrast to the JCPOA era, which relied on diplomatic frameworks to freeze Iran's nuclear program without active combat engagements. Now, the administration is boxed in. They're facing criticism from hawks who think they're being too soft, and dubs who think the whole escalation was a brain-dead idea. It's a reminder that you can't just negotiate complex geopolitics like you're buying a casino in Atlantic City. While the politicians are fighting over power, the rest of us are just trying to survive the physical toll of sitting at a desk all day. The news here is actually pretty hopeful, if you can find 5 minutes. Research from Manoush Zomorodi's book, Body Electric, which was backed up by a massive study with NPR listeners and Columbia University, shows that the damage from sitting isn't fixed by a gym session after work or even a standing desk. When you sit, your body kinks at the torso and knees, your circulation slows down, and your leg muscles basically stop processing glucose and lipids. That's how you end up with diabetes and heart disease, even if you think you're active. But here's the fix. 5 minutes of movement every hour. That's it. The study found that just 5 minutes of walking in place or even a quick dance break significantly improved blood sugar, blood pressure, and focus. One participant, Dana, actually reversed her diabetes just by integrating these movement snacks. And for the corporate types worried about the bottom line, productivity actually went up. It's a simple reminder that our bodies aren't just vessels for our brains to get to the next Zoom call. They actually need to move to keep the engine running. Speaking of things that are hard to swallow, food prices. They're up nearly 30% since before the pandemic. This isn't just about inflation as a vague concept. It's a fundamental shift in how we eat. We're seeing a weird kind of interdependence born out of desperation. Some restaurants are moving to pay-what-you-will models just to keep the lights on and the community fed. And it's not just the people buying the groceries who are hurting. The producers, the cattle ranchers and fishermen are getting squeezed by their own rising costs. They're often shopping in the same aisles we are, staring at the same price tags for the food they helped produce. The U.S. cattle herd is shrinking despite high demand, which means those steak prices aren't coming down anytime soon. It's a fragile system, and right now, everyone from the ranch to the register is feeling the heat. Over in the Indo-Pacific, the U.S. is essentially telling its allies to check the bill. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke at the Shangri-La Dialogue and made it clear, if Asian allies want to stop China from becoming the regional bully, they need to start paying up. This is a massive shift. For decades, the U.S. was the sole provider of security in the Pacific. Now Hegseth is framing defense spending as a way for allies to avoid freeloading. It's a risky move. On one hand, it shares the burden. On the other, it could trigger a massive regional arms race. Interestingly, the Chinese delegation actually applauded some of Hegseth's talk about strategic stability. It's a delicate dance, trying to get allies to arm themselves to the teeth without accidentally starting World War III. Back home, the legal system is being used in ways that should make anyone skeptical of equal justice a little nauseous. There's a ruling that Trump's name has to stay on the Kennedy Center because only Congress can change it. Fine, whatever. That's just red tape. But the real story is the anti-weaponization fund Trump set up. It's designed to compensate allies who feel persecuted by the Biden administration. Think about that. A president could potentially use taxpayer money to reward his friends through settlements with his own Justice Department. It's a complete collapse of the separation of powers. And then there's the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. Former Attorney General Pam Bondi recently testified, but she refused to talk about Trump's role in handling the files. Instead, she passed the buck to a deputy who just happens to be involved in that anti-weaponization fund and the E. Jean Carroll cases. If it smells like a coordinated effort to shield the boss from scrutiny, that's because it probably is. When the people in charge of justice are all part of the same political club, the system stops being a referee and starts being a bodyguard. Finally, we have to talk about the democracy paradox. The reality, reported by several outlets recently, is that American democracy isn't just under threat. It's structurally broken. Between the Electoral College and the Senate, a voter in Wyoming has way more power than a voter in California. It's a system designed for a version of America that doesn't exist anymore. Toss in gerrymandering, and most House seats are decided before a single vote is cast. Legal analysts are also pointing back to the Supreme Court's 2021 Brnovich decision, which significantly weakened the Voting Rights Act by making it harder to challenge state voting restrictions. Democrats are now in a shitty position, where they might have to break up majority-minority districts just to stay competitive, sacrificing black representation for partisan gain. We're also dealing with the fitness issue. We've seen it with Wilson and Reagan, and now we're seeing a constant stream of reports questioning whether the current leadership is physically up for another four-year grind. In a system where leaders are getting older and older, the public's right to know is constantly buried under political expediency. We're operating in a system that rewards noise and obstruction over actual governance, and until the incentives change, we're just rearranging deck chairs on a very expensive, very divided ship. The conversation around AI is shifting from what can this tool do to who is actually in charge when it breaks, and the answer right now is a whole lot of nobody. We're seeing a move in AI development away from deterministic systems, where A leads to B, toward probabilistic models. According to reports on AI's unseen costs, this is fundamentally changing the law of war. When a military AI assigns a 0.73 likelihood to someone being a combatant, it introduces an a priori acceptable margin for error. Because the decision-making is opaque, it becomes nearly impossible to pin down why a target was picked, which effectively nukes traditional accountability. If a machine makes a probabilistic guess that ends in a war crime, there's no clear way to hold a human responsible. There's also a growing push to stop talking about AI as some inevitable, uncontrollable weather pattern. The narrative of an unstoppable arms race is being called out as a bit of a convenient myth for the industry. Historical precedents like treaties on biological and chemical weapons show that international restraint is actually possible. Since a tiny handful of companies and elite researchers control the most advanced semiconductors, the leverage for regulation exists. We just have to decide to use it. Meanwhile, if you're looking for where the actual money is moving, it's toward governance. Clients aren't just asking agencies for cool AI-generated images anymore. They're demanding strategic partnerships and guardrails. According to recent market analysis, the client base is split into three groups: the strategic stewards, who want brand protection, the adaptive accelerators chasing speed, and the performance pragmatists looking at the bottom line. The interesting bit here is that clients are now holding agencies directly responsible for AI outcomes. They're looking for agencies to build the internal legal and ethical fences their own C-suites are too scared to touch. It's a shift from being a service provider to being a sort of intellectual bodyguard. Basically, if you aren't an expert in AI risk management, you're becoming irrelevant. That risk is already playing out in the open source world, and it's messy. AI is currently flooding open source projects with a deluge of low-quality, unvetted code contributions. It's the extra finger problem. The code looks functional at a glance, but it's often missing context or harboring subtle errors. Maintainers, who are usually volunteers, are getting buried under these pull requests. It's eroding the foundational trust of open source collaboration, forcing some projects to flat-out ban AI-generated code just to keep the lights on. But the biggest, most existential shift being reported is what happens to us when the work goes away. We're looking at a potential reality where AI reaches superintelligence by 2046, which sounds like sci-fi until you realize it threatens the fundamental status system of the last two centuries. In our current setup, work is how you prove you're a serious person. It's the centerpiece of identity. If you take that away, you get what sociologists call anomie, a total breakdown of shared standards. There are two schools of thought on how we handle the post-work void. The organismic view says we should let new values emerge naturally. They point to the Finnish universal basic income pilot, where people didn't just become lazy, they spontaneously started volunteering, caregiving, and doing creative work because they found it more meaningful than their old jobs. Then there's the institutionalist view, which is a lot darker. They argue that humans don't handle sudden voids well. When you destroy jobs rapidly, people don't always go paint landscapes. Sometimes they scream for status and turn to authoritarian movements that offer a manufactured sense of worth through exclusion and scapegoating. Think Weimar Germany, but with better algorithms. The middle ground being proposed is piecemeal social engineering. It's the idea that we need modest, democratic policies to start legitimizing things like civic service and caregiving as worthy contributions now, before the old labor-centric identity completely crumbles. Because if we wait for the machines to take the jobs before we decide what a worthy life looks like without a paycheck, someone a lot less democratic is going to define it for us. Now, while we're talking about high-stakes competition and the future of work, let's look at a world where the athletes are still very much flesh and blood, though the economics are just as messy. The current NTRA top thoroughbred poll has Wida Barrio sitting at the number one spot, despite a general consensus that the reigning horse of the year, Sovereignty, is the better athlete. Wida Barrio jumped to the top, following a head-to-head win, but as trainer Dale Romans noted on the Horse Racing Radio Network, that win was opportunistic, capitalizing on a moment when rivals were dealing with layoffs, which is racing speak for horses being rested off the track, or illness. Turf writer Tim Wilkin admitted that while he recognizes the win, he'd still pick Sovereignty in a direct matchup. It highlights a pretty annoying reality in the sport. The polls prioritize what happened last week over a horse's actual class or potential at their best. This isn't just a matter of hurt feelings in the stable. It actively misleads the betting public, who look at these rankings as definitive endorsements. Meanwhile, horses like Journalism, who finished right behind Sovereignty, are barely getting a mention. It's a classic case of rewarding the guy who showed up to a half-empty room, instead of the one who's actually the best in the world. And if you aren't running classic distances, the industry barely knows what to do with you. Romans and Wilkin both pointed out that the sport has a massive bias against sprinters. They're viewed as specialists who can't run long, and that translates to a lack of respect in Hall of Fame voting, and more importantly, lower value in the breeding shed. The prestige is almost entirely parked at the classic route distances, which essentially tells breeders that if a horse is just fast, it's a second-class citizen. The bigger crisis, though, is that the actual population of horses is shrinking. We're seeing a declining foal crop, which is leading directly to smaller field sizes and race cancellations. According to the Equine Forum, Trax are trying to fix this with band-aid solutions like bonus purses or waiving shipping fees. Romans argues that's just moving the same pile of money around. The real issue is that the economics of breeding and ownership are broken. Right now, racing secretaries are competing with each other for a dwindling number of horses. Because there are so many different race conditions available, owners just sit around and wait for the perfect race instead of entering their horses. This paradoxically leads to those tiny, boring fields that no one wants to bet on. Honestly, it's a mess. If the industry doesn't move toward a national framework for scheduling and find a way to make breeding actually viable again, we're just watching a slow-motion collapse. You can't run a sport if you literally run out of athletes. Looking ahead to the dirt, the field for the Blaine Stakes at Churchill Downs is wide open because the heavy favorite is sitting it out. That's leaving the door open for horses like Hit Show and Rattle and Roll, and even an Ohio-bred underdog named Hootie. It's a good betting opportunity, sure, but it's also a symptom of the same problem. When the stars aren't aligned perfectly, the top tier just stays in the barn. The future of local news is currently being litigated in state houses and newsrooms, and the argument is moving away from how much we write to who we're actually writing for. Jeff Jarvis is arguing that the survival of journalism by 2026 depends on a total pivot away from the content factory model of the print era. He says the traditional move of mass-producing articles to chase trends is just overwhelming audiences and wasting resources that should be used elsewhere. It's a quality-over-quantity argument, but with a specific focus on community utility. Jarvis thinks news organizations need to stop acting like external observers and start acting like community partners. That means instead of just filing stories, journalists should be listening to what people actually need help with, specifically in areas like housing, transportation, and supporting local businesses. The idea is that if you aren't fostering a conversation or a direct relationship with the public, you're basically just noise. There's also the messy question of who pays for all this. Public policy funding for journalism is becoming a reality, but Jarvis notes that this carries a massive risk to editorial independence. He points to the New Jersey model as a potential fix, where state funds are distributed through independent boards with very specific missions to keep the politicians' hands off the wheel. Look, the reality is that every funding source is a minefield. Whether it's ads, subscriptions, or philanthropy, there's always a conflict of interest lurking in the background. Jarvis's take is that we can't avoid the conflicts, so we have to lean on ethics and a clear mission to navigate them. But he's pretty cynical about the legacy brands, the big old newspapers, being able to pull this off. He argues it's actually more effective to start a local news org from scratch than to try and fix an old one, because those legacy cultures are too entrenched to actually innovate. Whoa. Honestly, he's not wrong about the culture problem. Trying to turn a 100-year-old newspaper into a nimble, community-first digital partner is like trying to parallel park a cruise ship in a bike lane. The content era of the internet, where we all just churned out SEO bait to keep the lights on, has clearly failed to save local news. But the pivot to community-centric models isn't exactly a walk in the park either. It requires a level of humility that a lot of old-school journalists frankly don't have. It's a lot easier to stand on a pedestal and tell people what's important than it is to sit in a room and actually listen to them complain about bus routes. Jarvis is also pushing for things like open newsrooms and community-focused blogs to build that trust back. It's about being a responsive partner rather than a lecturer. If journalism is going to matter in 2 years, it has to prove its value by contributing to the actual well-being of the neighborhood, not just by hitting a daily word count. It's a nice vision, but community-centric is one of those phrases that sounds great in a manifesto and gets very complicated when the state board starts looking at your budget, or when a local business you're partnering with does something shitty. Whether new startups can actually embed themselves deeply enough to survive where the giants failed, well, that's the gamble. We're basically watching a total teardown and rebuild of what we think a reporter even does. If Jarvis is right, the content creator is dead, and the community organizer with a notebook is the only one left standing. The Daily Stoic recently covered the rise of systemic burnout in high-stress fields like healthcare, arguing that the key to survival isn't waiting for the system to change, but changing your cognitive relationship to it. They suggest that bureaucratic obstacles and global crises should be viewed as indifferent forces. Treating them as personal attacks is a cognitive error that leads to victimhood. Instead, they advocate for amor fati, or a love of fate, where you treat dehumanizing systems as a gym for practicing virtues like patience. Look, telling a burnt-out nurse to love their fate sounds dangerously close to corporate gaslighting. But the point here is about internal agency. The podcast notes that this stoic muscle only works if you're actually sleeping and eating. Without basic self-stewardship, virtue is basically impossible to perform. On the growth side, Jay Shetty is reporting that personal excavation is the only way to distinguish your authentic self from external validation. He notes that even small habits, like asking, "How do I look in this?" outsource your internal feelings to others' opinions. To fix this, Shetty argues against the holistic overhaul. Don't try to fix your diet, sleep, and gym routine in the same week. He suggests picking one tiny, manageable shift and making it the highest priority. It's the same logic for trauma. Healing comes from cleansing the past through journaling until you can explain your experience simply. If you can't explain it simply, you haven't processed it yet. Finally, for the entrepreneurs, the word of the day is lane picking. A recent report on entrepreneurial mastery argues that shiny object syndrome is an operational disease. Launching a side hustle on Monday and a new agency on Wednesday doesn't show ambition, it shows a dilution of energy. Unshakable wealth, according to the report, is built by ruthlessly saying no to good ideas so you have the bandwidth for the great ones. It's a bit of a hustle culture trope, but the math checks out. You can't dominate a market if you're constantly distracted by the next big thing. Pick a lane and stay there. A few other things worth knowing before you head out. First, Argentina is proving that being a tactical shapeshifter pays off. Lionel Scaloni doesn't give a shit about rigid formations. He swaps systems based on who's actually fit to play, which is why they have a World Cup trophy and your fantasy squad probably has a few overlooked assets worth grabbing. It turns out vibes and flexibility is actually a high-level sporting strategy. If you're trying to get into Stoicism but find the ancient texts a bit dry, try a novel instead. Books like The Moviegoer or Memoirs of Hadrian basically dramatize the philosophy, letting you see how these ideas actually work when a character is dealing with a midlife crisis or a dying empire. It's much easier to digest than a dusty lecture. Over in the Champions League, Arsenal's defensive masterclass against PSG eventually backfired. They were so focused on being reactive and solid that they stopped being proactive, which eventually left just enough space for a penalty to ruin the night. It's the classic football trap. You spend so much time trying not to lose that you forget how to actually win. And finally, a reminder that the biggest and fastest is usually a red flag for "we skip the safety checks." The Verrucht waterslide was built on an aggressive, ego-driven timeline that bypassed basic engineering standards. And the result was as predictable as it was horrific. If a project's main selling point is its sheer audacity, maybe just stay on the ground.